Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 69. From 60 Minutes producer to positive psychologist, January 5th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
One of the kind of the foundational kind of formulations, excuse the expression, of positive psychology is that there are three pillars to what I call the well-lived life. The first pillar is pleasure, a warm blanket, you know, a great meal, a rich conversation. Second pillar is what's called engagement, which means connection to the world in terms of our strengths, what we're good at, finding a way to apply and contribute to the world in terms of our strengths, because that's really where the satisfaction comes. And then the third pillar is this larger question of meaning. How do I make my life about something larger than just pleasure, or larger than just connection?
That was the voice of John Drimmer, PhD, who has distinguished himself as one of the new leaders of the field of positive psychology. He's been teaching at UCLA's medical school and has founded the Positive Psychology Center of California. He comes to this work with a really unusual background. Dr. John Drimmer spent 3 decades making film and television programs in Hollywood. All that time, he's been a close student of the human drama and human psychology. His shows are seen far and wide. He was a producer for 60 Minutes. He helped found the History Channel and executive produced hundreds of programs for the Discovery Channel, National Geographic, the Learning Channel, and A&E, the Arts and Entertainment Channel. He's also written Hollywood movies, including Iceman, which was produced by Universal. He's also a winner of the DuPont Columbia Award, the Genesis Award, and the Aurora Award, and the National Telly Award. In addition to all this, he's writing a book about how adults find meaning in their lives. So let's get into the interview. Dr. John Drimmer, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, Dave.
You and I haven't met in person, but I want to bring the audience in on the fact that we've had some interesting telephone conversations and we've exchanged emails. And actually, I first heard from you as a listener to a Shrink Wrap Radio episode, I think on NLP, and you wrote in to comment on that. And then I discovered that you're a psychologist. And then I did a Google search on you and further discovered that you're an award-winning television producer, among other talents. So welcome again.
Thanks, Dave. Good to be here.
Yeah. I like it when listeners become guests on the show. It's not the first time that it's happened, and hopefully it won't be the last. So let's jump into your very interesting psychological and media career. Now, unlike most psychologists who sit in an office and often hear about life secondhand, you've seen a lot of it for real. And I understand that some of it was pretty extreme stuff. What have you seen, and what did it teach you about the psychology of more normal lives?
Oh, what a good question. A lot. I've been with narco-terrorists in South American jungles.
Oh,
I've been with exorcists who were ostracizing demons in ways psychologists dream of. I've been with war heroes wondering where they went wrong. I've been with professional athletes who thought they were fighting to save their pride and their dreams and their futures. Go ahead.
In what capacity was that you were in the all of these situations?
Well, either as a filmmaker or a documentary filmmaker or an executive producer. These are all what I've done. I was a producer at 60 Minutes when I was in my 20s.
Okay.
And then went on to become an executive producer of many, many programs for National Geographic, Discovery Channel, the History Channel, the Learning Channel.
Right. And, I invite our listeners to Google you, John Drimmer. Go to Google and you'll see quite an impressive list of productions that you've been involved with.
But you asked me, I was just cataloging some of the stuff, but you asked me really what I'd seen and I think how it informs my work as a psychologist or what it's taught me about more normal lives, tamer lives,
yes.
No life is really tame. The stakes feel very high for everyone. It's
right.
Just the kind of... it's just the arena in which we act out the stakes.
Yes, isn't that the truth?
And what I've been really interested in is the question of how people change. Looking at character in conflict and asking myself, how do people tap into their resources of courage or resiliency or wisdom or of interconnectedness? Or not, or how do they not, and what keeps them from doing it, and what can we learn from it?
Yeah, because you've seen people in some pretty extreme situations, it sounds like.
Life is extreme.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just, these are, what's remarkable about these situations is these are crucible situations.
Exactly.
I guess. You can see I'm torn between thinking it's these are remarkable situations and not. I guess what one does when one chooses a subject for a documentary is one is looking for somebody who's heading in to some enormously charged conflict, and you're looking for a conflict that in which somebody has a great deal at stake, and you want to explore it with them. My approach to making documentaries and to doing psychotherapy is very collaborative. I want to explore it with the people, and hopefully, like good therapy, you come out of it. You come out of any documentary experience with the person understanding more than they went into it, and ideally, and this is what's most precious about it, about being a documentarian and about being a therapist. You're changed by the experience as well.
Mm-hmm. That might be something we would want to come back to and sort of tap into maybe how you've been changed by this process. But I also want to keep moving here, and it's always fascinating to explore how psychologists choose their approach. And I've interviewed a few people who've been involved in positive psychology, and I know that your experience somehow led you to identifying as a positive psychologist. How did that come about?
Yeah, it's been a fascinating journey for me. My career as a psychologist started long ago, in a sense. As a young man, I was drawn to both of these callings, and was being trained as a Gestalt therapist at the same time I was working at 60 Minutes. Now, of course, something like working 60 Minutes is consuming.
That sounds very unusual.
And I made a choice to do the documentary work and worked as a therapist, very part time, often on the weekends or at a community mental health center in the evenings.
I'm curious how you managed to break into something like being a producer for 60 Minutes, which is a major show. And I, from what you've said, I gather you were in your 20s at the time. How the heck did you pull that off?
Let's see, how did that actually happen? I made a film for public television about life inside of a high-rise, what were then called high-rise ghettos in Newark. And it won an award that's given out by the folks who give out the Pulitzer at Columbia, an award called the DuPont Columbia Award. And I went to receive my award, and I was sitting next to Mike Wallace.
Oh, boy.
And and I was hired by CBS News and went to work for them.
So that's great. So then coming back to then how that led to you becoming a positive psychologist, you started out in Gestalt. You were dedicated to...
Right. Well, you know, the more I've looked at people's lives and at my own life, the more crucial the question of how people create meaning has come to seem to me. And by that I mean, it seems foundational, critical, profoundly important that each of us decide our lives are about something. And the people who I saw as I made documentaries who were able to tap in to this kind of deep, deep underwater current of resources and strength were people who understood what their lives were about, what they were living for, and usually had connected to something much larger. So at about the time that insight was dawning on me, and it took, the truth be told, years for it to become clear, I was growing increasingly frustrated with conventional psychology as practiced. In that, I found it was limited focus towards pathology and wasn't much good at getting people beyond beyond their problems. In other words, I could be very helpful in helping people deal with their problems, but to get beyond that into more optimal states of fulfillment, I just didn't have the tools. And I began to believe that it was in large part because psychology has never been very much concerned with this question of meaning. What's my life about? It was an area that had been relinquished to philosophers or theologians.
Of course, I have to ask you if you had been exposed to Carl Jung, because Jungians are very much concerned with that.
Yes, of course I was. I think they're concerned about it, and I'm talking to somebody who was in Jungian therapy but was never trained as a Jungian analyst.
Okay. Yeah.
I think they're concerned about it in ways that are, mythic, abstract,
abstract.
Or archetypal,
okay.
And the question is, how do we make this practical?
Okay.
And that's what I'm very interested in. I thought you were going to mention Viktor Frankl, whose work I know well.
Yes, sure. Also. We could mention him as well.
So I got very interested in this question of meaning. And that then led me to positive psychology, which is this sort of phenomenon that's taken place in the last 10 years in the contemporary world of psychology, in which a group of people are looking at how people create well-lived lives. And of course, meaning is a crucial part of it. Not all of it, but a crucial part of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, not only have you been a creator of network TV shows, but somehow you migrated to now being a practicing clinician, I gather. So how did that happen? And how did you have time to have these dual careers?
Well, you just make the time. And partly out of desperation, I suppose, because over the past 10 years, TV, I've gotten to do wonderful stuff. It's growing increasingly silly.
TV is growing increasingly
silly. Yeah, it's been getting sillier. Yeah. And for a whole variety of reasons that I probably don't need to go into here, but they all have economic motives.
Yeah.
I felt I just needed to do more work as a clinician. And I worked at a community mental health center here in Los Angeles, seeing people for free. Mm-hmm. And got a great deal out of it, and have gradually, and it began to influence the choice of subjects I was taking on in the documentary realm as well.
So your work as a psychotherapist was influencing your media work.
Enormously.
Yeah, how so?
Well, in terms of the kinds of material I chose and how I went about it. So I'll give you an example of how I went about it, and then I'll give you an example of the kind of material I chose.
Okay.
So the how I went about it is, let's talk about the process of drawing somebody out in front of a camera. Okay.
Yeah.
That can be a formal and sort of almost ritualized process as conducted, let's say, in one of the big network news magazines. Right.
Okay.
There are many
mm-hmm.
people watching. It's a sort of mano a mano. It's a dance. That's not ideal. That doesn't encourage candor or self-discovery.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking, this is a parenthesis here, to Mike Wallace about, the conversation that was really, really illuminating was I was talking to Mike Wallace's camera person. And I said, how does Mike do it? How does he get, particularly in the when he was doing those adversarial interviews, how does he get people to give it up?
Yeah.
And this guy, whose name was Larry, said, oh, it's when they're changing the film roll. And I said, what goes on? And he said, He's bonding with them. He's becoming best friends with them. So one of the things I realized from being a therapist about the interview process is it's not important to be brilliant. It's not important to have a kind of lance-like, kind of cutting, acute kind of intelligence.
Uh-huh.
What's really important is to make people feel, you know, unconditional positive regard, to quote Carl Rogers.
Interesting, you know,
so
how
they
always keeps coming back to that.
So they feel safe and welcomed. And my interview skills grew greatly once I stopped trying to be so smart.
Uh-huh.
Now to shift to the larger question of the kind of material I chose. The last two big projects I've worked on in the media world, one was a series for A&E called Intervention.
A series for who?
For A&E, Arts and Entertainment.
Oh, A&E.
It used to be called Arts and Entertainment.
Okay,
it's now called
right,
A&E.
The A&E Network, right.
Uh-huh, the A&E Network called Intervention. And this is a series that goes into the lives of somebody who is acting out addictively and is kind of desperately trying to stop but unable to,
mm-hmm.
and explores what's happening with them and their family, and then chronicles the entry into their life of an interventionist. And explores calling the kind of addict into this kind of moment of confronting what they're doing with their lives.
Is this where the whole family and all the friends, they all come together and do the big confrontation?
And talk about character in crisis and talk about ethical dilemmas. But
did you have a release from the person, for example, who was the confrontee who finds himself not only being confronted, but there are cameras in the room?
Well, of course. I mean, but it's a more far more complex process than that. The first time, this is a series that has been, I think it's in its fourth season now. I did the pilot, so I had to figure it out. And the very first episode of it we did was with about a young man named Gabe, who had been was the second youngest person ever go to UCLA. Got in at age 16. So this gifted young guy who'd become a gambling addict. And was so out of control that his parents had had to had lost their house paying off his debts, and had tried to suicide four times.
Oh my goodness!
He expressed interest in being the subject of this series. Now, the way it worked was we told Gabe that we were making a documentary about him and his attempt to kick his addiction. And we asked his permission to talk to his family and to record them on videotape. What we did not tell him was that as part of our discussions with his family, they were interested in an intervention. The TV series was providing the family with addiction treatment for Gabe after the intervention, should he choose to go into it, and we didn't know whether he would or not. So, of course, we needed a release in the very beginning. But more than that, once I realized what we were dealing with, I had to be sure that the whole process wasn't going to destabilize this young man.
Yeah.
And actually, a day or two after we started, I shut the whole thing down because I heard that he'd attempted suicide.
That was a very serious assessment. Yeah, that was after the session, the video session that he made an attempt?
No, well, the videotaping went on for months.
Oh, I see.
This was after just the very, very first interviews with him.
Okay.
Long before the intervention. But it was a show full of a lot of ethical concern, and I tried to bring a great deal of care and integrity to that process. Because TV exploits people, and that's not right. Story has a happy ending. He's been clean, so to speak, hasn't gambled in the last 2 years.
Oh, that's great.
And I got to know his family very well, cared about them a lot. The most recent program I did was a series for the Learning Channel, in which I've gotten very interested in how illness presents people with great opportunity to kind of either, if they make find are able to find meaning in it, it can change and deepen and enrich their lives. And if they don't, it becomes just the most difficult kind of encounter with the chaos of existence.
Right.
And I'm also interested in doctors and their experience of helping people understand their lives in that way. So this was a series called Guardian Angels MD, in which what we did was we found a patient going through some very serious health challenge, outcome unknown, And we found a medical doctor who is a wonderful, wonderful healer. And we paired the two of them. And we said, okay, doctor, you're going to spend the next 6 months helping guide this patient through this disease process, this surgery, this recovery. You're not going to be their primary care doctor, but you're going to be their guide partner. And let's see what the two of you learn from this process. Mm. So we recorded their two lives over that six-month process.
Wow.
And the first story we did was about a Broadway dancer. He'd been the top. He'd been in Cats. He'd been in Chorus Line. He was one of the top Broadway dancers whose hips were rotted out. He could barely walk past the theaters that he used to dance in. He was told that the operation to replace his hips might leave him unable to dance ever again. And he was in a serious crucible.
Yeah, so.
And wondering what it all meant. I paired him with an extraordinary young doctor I found who had been a history teacher before he became a doctor. Had driven an ambulance before he became a history teacher.
Wow.
And the two of them learned a great deal from each other and changed each other's lives in ways that are still forming and being shaped. And my life too. They're both close friends of mine now.
They sound like marvelous television series programs, and I didn't catch them. I wish I had, and maybe they'll be replayed or be in video stores or something. It's a lot of good TV programming, I think, probably just disappears, unfortunately.
Off into the ionosphere, Dave. I mean, this is one of the problems with TV. It's entirely perishable, and it's really used. It's not ever put to any good use. And that's one of the, I mean, if I'm going to continue working with media, I want to find ways to use it as part of social networks or as part of training tools or as part of ways to help people expand and grow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now,
I've also been teaching at the medical school at UCLA and taking some of my experience in this recent documentary series and some of what I learned from watching these experiences up close trying to bring some of it to the medical students.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. Is there a certain course that you're teaching or are you coming in?
Yeah, it's a course called Cultivating the Healer Within.
Oh, wonderful.
At UCLA, and it's really the first time positive psychology is being used in the medical school. One of the things I've been most interested in doing is working with these young medical students about to explore what the meaning of medicine actually really is mm-hmm. to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing to write an application to medical school. And it's another thing to decide honestly what the meaning of this calling is for you.
Mm-hmm. I notice you keep coming back to meaning, and you said that it was your own interest and the quest for meaning that brought you to positive psychology. And yet I'm not sure what the linkage is there between meaning and positive psychology. The exposure that I've had to positive psychology, I don't recall that it particularly emphasized meaning.
It does. One of the kind of the foundational kind of formulations, excuse the expression, of positive psychology is that there are three pillars to what I call the well-lived life. Not happiness, because happiness comes and goes, but the well-lived life. Well-lived life has happiness, but it's not the happy life. So at any rate, three pillars, three essential ingredients we need all in different proportions at different times, but we need them all.
Mm-hmm.
The first pillar is pleasure, a warm, blanket, you know, a great meal, a rich conversation. Second pillar is what's called engagement, which means connection to the world in terms of our strengths, what we're good at, finding a way to apply and contribute to the world in terms of our strengths, because that's really where the satisfaction comes. Mm-hmm. And then the third pillar is this larger question of meaning. How do I make my life about something larger than just pleasure, or larger than just connection?
Well, that's great. That's the best presentation, formulation of positive psychology that I've heard so far.
Gosh, well, thank you.
Yeah, I like that. And you've even started something called the Positive Psychology Center of California. Tell us a little bit about that and what's led up to that.
Well, what led up to that is realizing that this is so fascinating to me, because here we have, here in positive psychology, we have this enormously important shift in how to think about the work we're doing, and yet it's almost entirely still contained within academic environments.
Yep.
And the only really practical world that's getting applied a lot within is the business world. Mm-hmm. And most of that is back east. And out here in Southern California, most clinicians know nothing about it. It's extraordinary to me. So we formed the Positive Psychology Center of California to combine the practice of positive psychology, training professionals in different allied fields in positive psychology, and to do some research in it. And our website is thepositivepsychologycenter.com.
You just read my mind. That was what I was going to ask you next.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thepositivepsychologycenter.com.
.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll all take a look at that. And so, for example, how practical is positive psychology in dealing with people, say, who are depressed or anxious?
Enormously important. There's been relatively little work done in this kind of whole world of how to make it practical. Mm-hmm. There's a preface to a book written by the late Rick Snyder, in which he talked about looking at finding a bird's nest with his son, and there were little chicks inside the bird's nest, and they were flapping around, and his kid looked at his dad and said, "Geez, there's a whole lot of flapping, but not much flying, Dad." And Rick said, sort of like positive psychology, there's a lot of flapping, but not much flying. Flying in terms of how do we make it practical. Okay, yeah. So you asked me, how do you help somebody who's depressed or anxious? I'll give you an example. Details changed. One of my clients is a 22-year-old female grad student studying physics. She came to grad school with her boyfriend. They both enrolled in the same graduate school and broke up 2 months before arriving. Sank into a deep depression, began isolating herself. So in terms of those three pillars, she had almost no pleasure in her life and wasn't concerned about it. And it became very important to begin to kind of help her redevelop the ability to build pleasure into her life. But larger than that, was the question of meaning. And she and I began to explore what her life was about and what it was going to mean. Mm-hmm. And we began to find something she cared deeply about that wasn't about physics at all, and was enormously exciting to be in the room as somebody connects with that and begins to not only get in touch with it and begin to think about how to actualize it. And one of the things we know about meaning is it's not enough simply to think about meaning. One has to kind of, you need big meaning, like, you know, that's like the kind of the city on the hill, mm-hmm. in the distance on the horizon. But you also need ways to get there, practical, proximal goals. Mm-hmm. Short-term goals, long-term goals together make a happy person and get you someplace that matters. And so we began to build those. And those function like, you know how there's a sunken ship, the way they pull it up is they don't drop lines down and grind on the lines and haul the ship up. What they do now is they drop these gigantic balloons,
right.
and they put them under the ship.
Yes.
And they inflate it.
Yes.
And to give somebody the kind of personal discovery and relationship to what their life matters is like floating, inflating those balloons underneath.
Mm-hmm. Nice you know, metaphor.
The ship.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, that's a beautiful metaphor. Let me press you just a little bit, and I know you're going to have a good answer for this. In my own darker moments, I sometimes think that positive psychology may be philosophically naive. It seems to me that the wisdom of Jungian psychology and Eastern thought both tell us that we'll always be dealing with yin and yang, the dark and the light, and that our sorrows are as important as our joys. What are your thoughts about this?
My thoughts about this are, of course, absolutely. It fits into positive psychology. Positive psychology is not happyology or smiley face psychology. What it means, this is why I said it, this is why I called it the science of the well-lived life. It's about engaging life realistically and making absolutely the most of it that we can while we're here. I've been a lifelong Buddhist practitioner. There's no contradiction at all. Mm-hmm. In fact, Buddha was in some ways a positive psychologist.
How so?
Now you stopped me. Okay.
Well, it's a great. It's a great thought, and it could be the title.
Let me answer this because it's a really good question. It's going to be hard for me to, you know. Alan Wallace wrote a big piece in the APA Journal about this. He's a Buddhist philosopher. Okay, so let's leave that. Do you
think
I answered your question? I'm happy to kind of engage this question a little more.
Yeah.
About it being naive. What part do you, so let's resume this. So tell me more, Dave, about what you think's naive about it.
Well, I think you answered it really when you said that positive psychology is not about happyology or smiley faceology, and maybe I was coming from that simplistic view of it. Really, you've presented a more rounded picture of it than I've heard elsewhere, and I wonder if you're thinking of writing a book, because I think that you might bring a unique perspective to it. Well, I know you would.
What do you hear me say? I'm interested in what you hear me saying that you haven't heard said from other people.
Well, the three pillars, for example. Now, not that I've read everything out there on positive psychology. I've actually only read a little bit. You know, I've read mm-hmm. Seligman's book. I've read Csikszentmihalyi. And I've interviewed a few people.
Well, I'd only write a book if I was convinced I was going to contribute something unique to it. And so far, I'm not sure.
Has somebody else articulated the three pillars?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, who's done that?
Everybody.
Okay. I just need to...
I mean, that's pretty fundamental stuff.
You know, the other place, I guess, where I've felt a little shaky about positive psychology, I mean, part of me embraces it, and I always have this questioning side of myself as well that I can't seem to get away from. I have initial enthusiasm, and then I have second thoughts, and that tends to be my pattern. And so sometimes I wonder how robust positive psychology is when much of it seems to have been based on research. You mentioned how academic it's been. Much of it's based on research in which people fill out paper and pencil surveys about how they're feeling at various times during the day. At least initially.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. It's not a panacea. It's a different interpretive lens. And by providing that different lens, you're offering a different worldview. And the different worldview leads you to novel answers to questions that have been around for a long time, but really have not been the way people, psychologists, it's not a system psychologists used consistently.
I just thought of a way in which Buddha is a positive psychologist.
How so?
Well, the Buddha and meditators examine their thoughts. They follow their thoughts during meditation. Watch the thoughts come, watch the thoughts go, and hopefully without attachment to them. And there's a way in which positive psychology, part of what that's inviting people to do, is to look at their thought processes and be aware of them, not get hooked in by negative, self-defeating thoughts.
Absolutely. And your thought triggered a thought of mine, which is one of the most profound and simple meditations the Buddha offered us is a meditation on loving kindness. And ways to understand our connection to all sentient beings.
Yes.
That's called a metta meditation. And then there are other meditations called Tonglen meditations, which are meditations on compassion. And not only compassion and loving kindness for the other, but for oneself.
Yes.
And it's the nectar of the good life. You know, really, without that, there is no wonderful life. Without care and concern for others, there is no, and for oneself, there is no wonderful life.
I was speaking with a friend just yesterday, and kind of having an interview like this, and he referred to the L word, and the L word is love, and that's the word that often is unspoken in psychology that we're shy about speaking, and you know, and the kind of compassion that you're talking about both towards others and towards oneself can also be understood as a form of love.
I have a terrific story for you. Marty Seligman, who's really the fellow who founded this school of this approach called positive psychology, was doing an executive training program. And these were executives who were brought in, I guess, for a weekend or 2 weekends and paying a lot of money to be trained in positive psychology. And they showed up in his classroom and he said, well, this is going to be a very brief class and today. And he pulled out a wad of $100 bills. And I may not have a story exactly right, but I've got the point right. And he pulled out a lot of $100 bills, and he said, okay, guys, I want you to divide yourselves into two groups. So he had 10 of the people on one room, one side of the room, and the other 10 on the other side. I said, okay, you guys and gals on the left side of the room, I'm going to give you each $100. And I want you to go off for the next 4 hours and each of you use your $100 to increase your happiness in the most significant way you think you can. Now, I suggest you pool it and go off to the finest restaurant we have here in Philadelphia and get to know each other and talk about what you want to do with your lives, and then come back in 4 hours. And they said, great, that sounds terrific. And they went off. And then the other people who were left in the room, he said, I don't have any money for you. What I've done for you, and you're not going to get to eat lunch either. What I've done for you is I've made arrangements. There's a hospice down the street. And I've made arrangements for you to spend the next 3 hours at the hospice. Each of you is going to sit with somebody who's got a fatal disease and talk to them about life. And then be back here in 4 hours. So 4 hours passed and both groups reconvened. And he said to the group that had been out for the fine meal, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you put the meaning or the happiness or the reward you got from the last 4 hours? And they said, oh, geez, it was great. We talked and we shared and 8.5, really, really good. Mm-hmm. And then he turned to the people on the other side of the room who'd been in the hospice and said, okay, where would you put it? And they said, 10 plus, plus, plus. The most important experience of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great story. Well, we're beginning to get short on our time here. A couple more things I wanted to ask you about before we wrap it up. I know you're interested in midlife career change. What are you doing around that?
One of the things we're doing at the Positive Psychology Center, California, is we're doing a group, a six-month group for people who are looking to change their work and their lives. We're doing it over that time period and in that form because this is deep searching kind of work, and people can be very supported by other people who are going through it at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we're using a whole spectrum of tools from positive psychology to help people deal with deciding what they want to do and how to create goals and begin the move towards exploring it and making it real.
That sounds
cool. Can I tell you another little story?
Sure.
This is a story from an Indiana Jones movie, and it relates to the process of career change, and it relates to positive psychology. And it's something I talk to people about who are looking to make a career change. And it's a scene that occurs at the end of one of the Indiana Jones movies. I think maybe Temple of Doom, the one that had Sean Connery playing Indy's dad. Yep. And Harrison Ford reaches a chasm toward the end of the movie, giant chasm. There's no way across it. And on the other side of the chasm is the Holy Grail, for the youngins out there. Right. And the Holy Grail, which represents all of God's gifts to men. Yeah. But there's no way for Ford to get across. And I'm sure there are people chasing him, and it's the end of the movie, and he's got to get across, and he doesn't know what to do. And he pulls out an old, parched, yellowed map, and he sees a figure of a person walking across the chasm, but there's no bridge. He doesn't know what it means. And he thinks, and he turns to Sean Connery, and he says, this must be a leap of faith. And he puts his foot out across the chasm, and as he does, a slat appears.
Hmm.
And then as he takes the next step, another slat appears, and a rope bridge begins to form in front of him. And the reason I tell that story is because I think in making big changes in a person's life, these are all leaps of faith, emphasis on faith.
Right.
And and this is very much in keeping with positive psychology, one begins to look for the slats of the rope bridge as they appear. And the only way one of the exercises I do with people is I say, okay, what slat appeared today?
John, I think you're going to make everybody want to move to Southern California so that they can come to your center.
Well, that would be good.
It's sounding very, very inviting.
That would be good.
Yeah. So are you done with media and TV?
I don't think I'm entirely done with it, but I think I'm done with working in the kind of conventional frames. I'm very interested in how to use media to create social networks or to help people grow or learn or to inspire them. There's some fascinating work being done at Berkeley and at the University of Virginia with how to stimulate states of awe and inspiration in people.
Wow!
And they're using scenes from movies. They're showing them to people, and they're finding they have great power to stimulate those states and that kind of imaginative space.
Yes.
And if you could use, I mean, this is just freeform spitballing, if you could use media in that way and then build on it, then you'd have a really productive, interesting way to use it. And then there are other kind of really fascinating sort of phenomenons like this DVD, The Secret, that people have been distributing from, you know, by word of mouth over the internet.
Wait, what's
I don't know
this?
Whether you've seen that or not.
No, I haven't heard of this.
Well, it's a very, very interesting thing. I have some reservations about the content of it, but this is a DVD that I think was produced in Australia called The Secret. It's a series of interviews that deals with what some people call the law of attraction, which essentially means we see what we want to see, or if you push it, even further, the way some of the practitioners do, it means we are able to create in the world what we will to create. Now, that's a subject for many, many dissertations, what's interesting is that these people produce this DVD and it's a kind of powerful idea and a kind of well-made piece of media, and it's spread all over the world without ever being on a TV screen or in a movie theater.
Well, I think I know somebody I maybe can get it from. You. I'm hoping.
I think I could arrange it.
Yeah, okay. We can check that out. So to wrap things up here, well, just a couple more things. The great thing, you know, about a podcast as opposed to traditional media, I say we're running out of time, but in fact, it's totally up to me how much time we take. And it's my judgment, I guess, of how much our audience will tolerate. And I think that this has been a wonderful conversation, and I'm going to assume that they're going to tolerate it well. So I want to ask you, because you mentioned that you'd been in Jungian psychotherapy and maybe other approaches as well. So I wanted to ask you in what way psychology has helped you in your own personal life, either psychology, psychotherapy, these ideas?
Well, in enormous ways in ways that had left me disappointed.
Both. Both the positive and the negative. Yeah.
Both.
Say a little bit about each of those poles.
I feel the most important thing I ever did was join an ongoing therapy group. Because I think for me, what I needed most was to develop kind of honest, authentic, trusting relationships with other people over time. Mm-hmm. I feel one of the biggest wastes of time I ever spent was spending many years thinking about my childhood wounds. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's useful. I think it's useful as a way to understand oneself. But I think, and we know this, and kind of, you know, neuropsychology, the more neuropsychology we're doing, the more evidence there is of the fact that, you know, what you kind of perseverate on, what you spend a lot of time thinking about, i.e. your problems, is going to begin to kind of shape the way your brain operates. Mm-hmm. And if you begin to feel that the twig is broken, you know, then you begin to feel that the tree is bent and gnarled and deformed. And I feel there's enormous danger in it.
Danger in spending too much time being preoccupied with deficits.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And that I think one of the responsibilities of people who do this work is to bring their whole selves into the room with the client or patient, and that means, and here I kind of separate myself from a lot of people in the field. That means you better be pretty well developed yourself. Otherwise, who wants your whole self in the room?
Yeah, good point.
You know, there's this whole conflict in the field that you don't have to be able to, you know, lay an egg to know what a good egg is, you know. But I think you do have to put a lot of work in on your own life. And I think I learned a great deal from the therapist I had who were willing to share their lives with me.
Yeah.
A lot of learning, I think, comes from life.
Yeah. Well, that maybe segues into my final question, which is, what advice do you have for students who are considering a career as therapists or counselors?
Boy, what a great question. What a great question. I think the best thing to do is to, I think what would be terrific, the best way you could ever learn about it would be to spend 6 sessions with 4 different therapists from very different schools talking about your life.
Hmm.
Unfortunately, what most people do is they find a therapist and they stay with them for years and years and years. And then they spend most of their lives practicing exactly the way that therapist practiced.
Yeah. Okay, well, that is a unique recommendation. And John Drimmer, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're welcome. It's been really, really fun.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. John Drimmer. You know, I'm still trying to figure out how he managed to be going to graduate school and be a producer for a major television show like 60 Minutes at the same time. I can only conclude that he's a person of special and unique gifts, and that's the feeling I've had in our conversations. If you've been following this series, then you know this is my 3rd interview with someone identified with positive psychology. I definitely got a deeper sense of it in this conversation with John Drimmer. As you heard in the interview, I was especially taken with the formulation of the 3 pillars of positive psychology, or what John referred to as the well-lived life. Perhaps part of the reason this resonates so strongly with me is that I was strongly influenced years ago by a book called The 3 Pillars of Zen by Philip Kaplow. So the idea of 3 pillars already slides nicely into a ready-made slot in my brain. John's version of the 3 pillars of positive psychology also fits well with my own humanistic-slash-existential-slash-Jungian-slash-Buddhist view of the world. The three pillars you will recall were: one, pleasure in the sense of a warm blanket, a great meal, a rich conversation. And this puts me in mind of the great highs in my own life, making music with friends, skiing down a mountainside with friends, running along the surf at the beach, body surfing, holding my babies. These are some of the pleasurable highs that stand out in my own life. His second pillar was engagement, and I like the way he defined that in terms of connection to the world coming from our strengths. I've always felt that one of the natural highs, or happinesses, if you will, is the development and experience of competence. There is a joy in being able to do something, to contribute, to exercise one's strengths. And his third pillar had to do with meaning, seeing oneself within a larger plan, a larger context, a larger connection. I also felt that John and I are in accord that the well-lived life is not just about happiness. In my typical "it's all in your mind" fashion, I think the key thing is the attitude, the stance from which one regards both their highs and their lows, a kind of savoring of the mystery of life and of one's own fate.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And shrink wrap radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink wrap radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
I let this interview and the last couple run long, both because I found my guests fascinating and because of feedback from a few listeners that they would actually prefer longer, more in-depth interviews. Consequently, I'm not reading as many of the emails to try to keep the show from becoming taxingly long. I'd love to hear your reaction to this shift. One thing our listener survey and your emails make clear to me is that different people like different things. Some people like to hear the emails and some don't. Some want longer interviews and probably some don't. So I'll just keep searching for that sweet spot where I'm happy with what I'm doing, and where a substantial number of you are happy too. I can't resist reading at least one or two emails. Here's one from Jim in Melbourne, Australia, who writes, "Thanks for the acknowledgement regarding the Frapper Map, Dr. Dave. Your show continues to provide a great source of interest and inspiration, and I'm grateful to you for the time you put into it. I'm sure that the feedback from your audience is critical to your motivation, so I intend to be a bit more communicative. I've been one of the silent many out there who enjoy your show enormously but haven't told you so until I completed the survey recently." Hey, thanks for doing that survey. And he says, "By the way, Vic is, as you guessed the first time, short for the state of Victoria, down in the southeast corner of our big and drying continent. Thanks once again, Jim." Well, Jim, you're right that hearing from that silent majority out there does a lot to keep up my motivation. Some people wonder why I have taken time to read out the names of people who've added themselves to our Frapper Map, as I did with you. But your email reinforces my belief that it helps to build a sense of community and that people really appreciate the acknowledgement. Listener Mark wrote to suggest interviewing a food psychologist. He says, "There's a subset of psychologists that deal with smell and taste." And then he sent along web links to a number of related websites. So, Mark, thanks for that suggestion. I'll keep it in mind and eventually hope to act on it. I've been getting lots of suggestions, and it'll take me a while to catch up with all of them. I thought I had a lot of ideas for shows, but listeners have been sending me ideas that I never would have thought of, and certainly yours was one of them, Mark. And I'll read one more email. This one comes from Dennis, who writes, "Dr. Dave, hello, I finally have some time to relax and take a breath. I'm almost 36 and am a returning student. I had gone to school before, but not with any goal or major. I just took classes I was interested in. Going back this time, full-time, was just by chance. I was laid off. I was a carpenter and had enrolled in a class for getting into working on movie sets as a grip or something along those lines. Hey, that sounds like fun. That one class was 18 credits, and I qualified for financial aid. That got my gears turning, thinking about how I could go back to school and get a degree. When I started on the degree part, I began working on exercise science associate. I guess that's an associate degree. I was really drawn to the behavior change and other psychological aspects of my classes. I came into the topic with that interest as well. One of the classes I took to fulfill a requirement was Intro to Counseling Therapies. After getting to know the human services majors in my classes and further thought, I changed over to Human Services Associate Program. I think I'll get a master's in social work and perhaps continue from there. As far as I can tell, this is a very versatile degree, and I can take it in many different directions. I would eventually like a private practice, but I'll see as time goes on. I'm coming from a physical background and really am attracted to mind-body theories and therapies. I've been doing martial arts and yoga off and on all my life. Well, enough for now. Oh, I thought of something you might be interested in after I listened to one of your shows where an older gentleman told you about standing on a trampoline while working on your computer. That was Norman Shealy, actually. He says another possibility would be a stability ball or a stability ball chair. That is one of those big exercise balls. I sit on a ball, but you can get chairs that look more polished for more formal areas. Another good exercise area to look into is functional fitness and instability exercises. These work on your core and reveal how out of shape one may be. I was embarrassed when I began using these exercises. What I like about these newer programs are how brief they are. The ones I do are combat/martial arts circuits, and are often modeled on how wild animals get their exercise, fast, intense, and short. That's my blog, and you're certainly very welcome. Thank you, Dennis. Well, Dennis, I like the idea of exercise that's fast, intense, and short. Emphasis on short. So thanks for your suggestions and your concerns for my aging body. Actually, I'm planning a ski trip to Park City, Utah with my friend, Dr. Ron Alexander, who I interviewed some time back and with whom I've been conducting workshops in Europe. So knowing how out of shape I am, I went on the internet looking for knee exercises. I found some, did them very lightly, I thought, and I've really wrecked myself. My knees are screaming. I guess I need a personal trainer guy such as yourself. By the way, I think getting a master's degree in social work is indeed a very versatile degree. With that, I think I better wrap things up. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. And I love it when you leave voice messages on MyChingo, and there's a link on our website where you'll find that. Yeah, I also put a new player on the website that lets you scroll through and play any of the 69 shows that are up there now. And in the U.S., you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-888-2746. And do check out Podshow at podshow.com. You can actually subscribe to this show from that site, and you can discover many other interesting and wonderful shows there. And, of course, you can always order yourself a new domain name at GoDaddy by using our discount code of SHRINK3. Many thanks again to Dr. John Drimmer for the interview, and I think you'll find our next show fascinating. I will interview my friend Dr. Art Rosengarten, who has written a book on tarot and psychology. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying it's all in your mind.